You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.
Today on our show, we're talking with Jennifer Steinkamp. She is an American installation artist who works with video and new media. Jennifer, thanks so much for being with us today.
Oh, sure. Happy to be here.
So to begin with, I want to talk about parts of your career and your art, but what is it that's happening right now in your studio? What are you working on at the moment?
I'm creating a new piece for an exhibition in Hong Kong at Lehman Maupin Gallery for February. And I'm also working on a site-specific installation for Cedars-Sinai Hospital in Los Angeles.
And what will the Hong Kong installation look like? What kind of
There's two rooms. The first room is a piece called Bouquet, which is a bouquet of trees. They're, you know, like cut trees, as in, like cut flowers, but they're actually trees. And then the other one is a new piece. Well, I guess they're both new, but this one's being it's made for the exhibition. It's made up of tumbleweeds, and I'm just fooling around with it now, so it's a little. I think it's going to be called Diaspora. It's the Chinese New Year is when it's premiering, so it's I'm kind of curious how that's going to come across.
Right. And is Lehman Maupin, are you represented by Lehman Maupin?
Yes. Yeah, I've had many shows with Lehman Maupin in their New York galleries.
And your work, you know, though it's installation-based, there's also sculptural objects that come out of it. Is that what's often collected from your work, or are installations collected, or imagery? What is it that collectors can have?
They usually purchase video projections that are then installed in their house. So I don't make any objects.
Okay, so it's all video projections that they're
or monitor work and LED projects for public spaces.
And that's exciting. I mean, in a way, that mm-hmm. seems a difficult thing to collect. And I know many people do collect video and projections,
mm-hmm.
work that's more ephemeral like that, but it's...
Yeah, when
it
I first started
fun.
it was certainly more difficult. I think the projectors weren't very bright, and they weren't quite high enough resolution, and they were kind of bulky, and computers, which present the work, were all the same problem, really. They were, well, it's not the brightness, but they were kind of bulky, and people seem to be afraid of technology, and somehow at some magical moment everything's shifted, and so it doesn't seem to be an issue.
And it's not an issue with additions either, right? I mean, because there's also the issue, I would think, as a collector of, you know, it's so ephemeral, it is a projection, and though it's an original work, it's not... you know, like an original painting, or maybe
mm-hmm.
it is. I mean, how is that perceived, and is there any...
Well, there's a certain quantity. I mean, it's kind of the same issue maybe printmaking or photography might have, or I mean, really anything can be reproduced in some manner or another, and I guess digital media might be a little bit easier to reproduce and pass around, but you basically... you get discs that are an archive of the work and a certificate, and the work is on a master list. And so, you know, that it's just as difficult to make a copy as any other kind of medium.
I mean, in one way, in the world of so many objects being produced and everywhere, it seems like a kind of, I don't want to say greening of the art world in any way, but there's something about there being a lack of objects which seems kind of...
I don't think any art form... Well, there's probably a couple. Most art forms are not green. I mean, that's... I guess I hate to be the person saying that, but it's pretty true. They all involve some sort of technology and... you know, and materials that affect the world. So it's,
but just the lack,
I mean,
of
most everything is not green, really. I mean, if you want to look at it that way.
That's true. That's true.
And so, I mean, I'm using projectors and computers. Painters are using, you know, paint and materials and things that have been shipped across the country, et cetera. I mean, everything you do. So it's not really, it's not the issue.
Right, right. Well, I mean, what I meant by that is that the it seems that one of the issues is that there isn't a physical object. And maybe you see it as there mm-hmm. is a physical object, but the fact that there isn't a physical object is, you know, a shift, I think, at some point in contemporary art and contemporary collecting and contemporary thinking about art. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, that's a very different way of looking at what it means to own something, that when the
yeah.
projector's off, it disappears, or, you know, the electricity's off,
mm-hmm.
it disappears. It's
yeah.
it's art.
Well, I think the conceptual
object.
Art, the conceptual artists who just created ideas were probably the greenest artists around. You know, you might get a slip of paper that has the, you know, whatever the directions or something, and that's the art. So
like Sol,
I mean,
Sol LeWitt, you mean?
Uh huh. Sure. Exactly.
The drawing instructions. Or...
Mm-hmm.
That's true. And so in one way, this is. Within that context, to some degree, that kind of conceptual history.
Oh, it's a really. I find it strange to even discuss this because it's really not green at all. Because there's, you know, equipment.
No. I didn't say it was green. I said so, but it's in that history. I said, but it's.
I mean,
it's
there's nothing. I mean, it's interesting. There's no. Yeah, maybe shift it to there's. We're talking about an art piece that's made out of nothing, basically. There's no materiality. So that's the fascinating thing, because it's a lack of materiality that can give you a physical experience. And, I mean, that's one of the things that attracted me to working with projection and light and, you know, imagery projected into in environments. Because they do give you, this non-material gives you a physical experience.
You know, there's something, hesitating to use the word spiritual about that. This kind of something is there, but it's not there, yet it's palpable, it's
mm-hmm.
visceral, it's something we can have an emotional response to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's some kind of... I suppose emotional response that your body experiences, and it's like your body, you know, your body mind. It's like your hands know, or whatever. Your physical body knows. Yeah, I mean, to me, I don't even quite know what spiritual is, but you do and you feel it, but you really, you know, you don't know what it is. And I think that's the kind of word that I would leave to the interpretation of the viewer or the, you know, person thinking about it, because it's different for everybody.
Of course. Let's
yeah.
move back a little bit. I mean, because it's fascinating that you're in this position making these kind of installations and creating really experiences for people, as well as, you know, non-object objects that are brought into collections and loaned and transferred. What was it that first got you involved in art as, I don't know, maybe a child? It's interesting how you're in such a conceptual realm now, so I'm kind of interested how you got there as a child. Do you remember what drew you into art, or what got you excited about art to begin with?
Well, I grew up in Minnesota, and you're kind of trapped inside for a lot of the year because the weather's so terrible. And so, it's probably something like that. I know in first grade, my teacher said I made the best trees, which I'm kind of curious that must have affected my entire life, because I'm still making trees, apparently.
Right, you are. You've made a lot of trees.
Yeah.
And that's kind of interesting. I mean, you know, it's sometimes...
Yeah, so she was right,
It's what?
Pardon? No, she was
yeah.
right.
maybe she was right, or maybe, you know, she wasn't right, but you wanted that to be right. You know, it's interesting how I think mentors teachers can influence people, and you think, wow, maybe I am a great tree maker. So that's interesting. So you're obviously drawing at that point, right? You're drawing trees.
Who knows? Yeah. Well, I made all kinds of things, really. Nothing specific. And my family's not very artistic or anything. So, you know, never went to museums or anything like that until later. Or we did as tourists, but, you know, not with. Not like
and
maybe an artist family would go.
Well, you know, sometimes it's interesting. I interview a lot of different artists and people. Some artists, you know, most didn't seem to have families that were so sensitive to the arts, although some had, you know, a mother that read poetry or a father that, would take them to museums on vacation. Then it was on one of those vacations maybe where you see something and you think, wow, that's strangely of interest or something like that. So what was, then you went to... school after that at your where did you get a BA?
Art Center College in Pasadena. So I actually went there, took courses at Caltech, and then decided I needed to make computer generated work, and so I dropped out of school and worked in Hollywood, and then went back to teaching at Art Center actually, and then I finished up my degree. It took a long time.
Well, tell me a little bit about that. Tell me a little bit about Hollywood. So what was the decision that made you want to go out and go to Hollywood? Sounds very romantic.
I wanted to make sorry, my phone's being nuts. There were no personal computers at the time. I was in the 84. I think 87 is when the... sometime around 87 when the personal computer came out. It was a way to get access and to learn. So, you know, I just went ahead and did it.
Because you mean there was no other industry that had...
Well, you couldn't learn it in school. It was just beginning in art school. So, you know, access to computers and working and making art with computers was really out in the industry more. So that, you know, that was, it was a lot of things kind of just came together to, you know, the stock market crash, all kinds of things kind of came together to make that happen.
And what was Hollywood like? And what did you learn there? I think that's a particular influence of not just technology, but also kind of theatrical experience.
What I found it intriguing in that I was always learning something, and it was about problem solving. I never felt really satisfied, but it intrigued my mind enough. And I mean, I'm really kind of happy and never that satisfied, and always pursued something else. But it's kind of a place that'll burn you up. Oh, you're breaking up a lot.
I am. I can hear you clearly. If I can't hear you, if you can't hear me, let me know. But
okay.
So what happened in Hollywood? I mean, just to rephrase that, what was the job that you had there, or the learning experience there?
Well, I was mostly working on commercials and. Just learn that it's a lot of work. You work around the clock, and it sort of burns you out.
And then you went back to school.
While I was burning myself out, I was also making films, and I'd moved to New York, and trying to sort of find my way. And then I started teaching, and I decided that might be a good way to make some money and still be able to make my art, whatever that, you know, at the time I really didn't know. And then I moved back to LA and I started teaching at Art Center where I had dropped out from. And then after a little while, I went back to school and finished up my degree and figured out that I could, you know, make installation art basically.
And how did that come
about? It's kind
of
a weird career path.
Well, yeah, but it's an interesting one because in a way it seems, you know, as we're talking about it now, a kind of a path that was clear. I mean, besides having an early interest in trees, not that I'm trying to force this line too much, but your interest in computers and technology, you know, was fostered under a number of different ways, and you found a way ultimately to combine all of that in in installations. What was it? What was the point? Maybe it was in New York or coming back to LA where you realized installation was your medium, or that that was a way to work. Was there something that particularly made you feel
first,
that was working?
Well, let's see. The first major piece I made was a series of sexist slides, and I had projected them in Hollywood, actually. And let's see, one of my colleagues at school, Ken Riddle, he used his house for installation art projects, and he asked me if I would project that at his house in Pasadena. It's this craftsman-style house, and I thought, you know, I'd actually like to create a new piece, and so I made a piece with video projection in his windows, and it basically looked like this house dropped from another planet, you know, because it was so alien looking, as 87 or something like that. And it just really started. I just haven't stopped making, you know, installations in architecture since then.
So let's talk about his house a little bit, because that sounds like a, you know, if I'm not misreading it, that sounds kind of like a pivotal piece. What did his house look like exactly? It was, you said, an arts and crafts house? Or what was this?
Yeah, it's craftsman style, probably built around the 20s. It's a pretty typical house for Pasadena, actually. It's symmetrical, two big bay windows, and then, you know, you enter from the center. And at the same time, I was also had the opportunity to show the same piece at in Santa Monica at the Santa Monica Museum, and they had a storefront that was also two huge windows and a center entrance, and it seemed kind of like similar. And so I had the piece exhibit at both spaces simultaneously, and so it was the same projections but in two different architecturally inscribed spaces. So one's storefront and the other one's a home.
So just to understand exactly, like to visualize what was happening there, in the home, these are all rear projections coming from inside of the house onto the windows. And what were the projections of?
I decided to divide the house in half into a female and then a male half. And so I created a whole bunch of Earths that were orbiting with moons. So I don't remember how many, let's just say 15 or something. And then for the female side, I made this sort of vortex tunnel. So it was kind of exterior, interior, you know, pretty, you know, subtle, but just using a sort of metaphor to represent male and female. And so I did the same thing to the storefront.
So now I understand why that did look like it dropped from space and looked sort of like this interstellar experience that's, you know, coming from inside a home. So whether people read it in the context that you created it or not, it also was this kind of, you know, inside-out experience almost.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
As well, right? We look to the sky.
Yeah, it's funny. I come back to the same kind of imagery, so... It's curious that, you know, it's sort of something that stuck with me. Maybe not conceptually the same, but maybe metaphorically in approach similar. But definitely the planet, you know, outer space, science fictiony kinds of things.
So that sounds very exciting. And in the storefront, too, that was a similar projection of male and female?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It was the planets in a sort of tunnel.
And so what kind of a response did you get to that? Did you get much feedback? And how does that?
I didn't own the projectors. I borrowed them from a projector dealer. So I had 1 week. So I did get good response. Somebody got a jaywalking ticket, so it made me happy, I guess. Yeah. I mean, I don't think there was any press or anything.
But, I mean, it was enough response. I guess maybe it was just your own taking of it. But, I mean, it sounded like after that show or that both of those, I don't know if you call it a show, but installations, public work that you created, there was something that you decided was really working about that.
I needed to pursue it some more, certainly.
And so what was the next step after that? That was when you went back to school more?
Oh, my God.
You were still teaching?
Well, I was still in school. But at that point, that was in between undergrad and grad, I guess. I mean, it's a little odd when you drop out and then go back and, you know, you're sort of like an old – slightly older student, or maybe about five years or something.
But in a way, it's perfect. I mean, I think that's what, you know, grad school should be about, the point when you've made something like you've made and realize that's really interesting. I want to do a lot more of that. So rather than going to grad school just to explore, you kind of have had a recognition of what it is that you love, and a certain amount of technical support to be able to produce that.
Yeah. No, it's great to discover what it is you want to do. That's for sure.
And how did that develop in grad school? Did the content or content change of what you were doing then?
I think I tried a lot of different things. I don't know if it has the content changed? I would say things have developed. Yeah, I mean, it certainly has matured or evolved, but gosh, changing since that first piece, not a whole lot, not really. I mean, it depends on how you look at it.
Sure. Well, I mean, it was certainly time to work and create more. Create more art, essentially. But when you got out of grad school, what was the next thing that happened between, I guess, then and, well, I don't know if Lehman Maupin was the first gallery that...
No. They came a little later. The first project, I'd have to look to tell you the truth, but the first one I'm thinking of was in London at the Dreadnought Siemens Hospital. And it was a show that was sort of an exchange between... Well, that was actually between the UK and Los Angeles, and part of the show was in Union Station, the train station in LA, in downtown LA. So I created a couple pieces for that. That was probably the next major thing.
And that was major public art, really. I mean, the first pieces that we discussed previously, the house and the storefront, were also public art, but that's in another country and on a kind of grander scale, in a sense. And the first gallery that began exhibiting or representing was soon after that, or no?
Acme Gallery in Los Angeles. At the time, they were Food House, and Randy Summer, who's one of the directors, he worked for a gallery called Dorothy Goldine, and he had put me in a group show, and then I went on to exhibit with him at Food House and then Acme, and I've been with him for a really long time, since the 90s.
And so that was your first, it sounds like it was a great experience, and that was your first gallery experience, and...
Mm-hmm. I guess I'm really lucky to have really, great people to work with.
Because he was also selling your work at that time? Is that happening right too? Huh.
The Museum of Contemporary Art in Los Angeles bought a piece called that I had shown at Acme, or actually it was at Food House. It was Acme. So that happened pretty early on. That was pretty great. So yeah, I mean I'd say it took a little bit of time just because people were pretty afraid of technology and frankly it wasn't quite ready yet. Now, you know, projectors and things are pretty inexpensive and, you know, they're pretty small and pretty high resolution. So all those things factor in to make it much easier to deal with.
Right. That was a leap for a lot of museums. And that's when they also began collecting mm-hmm. Net art, right, which was also very risky. And
it's probably less risky, but yeah. Well, I guess,
well,
because it's now operating.
Yeah, in a way, it's more something designed for the you know, Netscape browser. There's almost no way to recreate that and generate the browser experience that was designed. You know, it's computers operate differently. There's kind of a huge, conservator issue in net art because how do you, mm-hmm. you know, get that old computer and that old dial-up connection and what do you do?
Know. Yep.
It's really tricky. So
and some artists insist on keeping the old technology and not migrating to whatever's available, because for whatever reason that technology, the old monitors or whatever, was part of the work.
Hmm.
Which that is a certain death because it's just not going to exist.
Right.
I make sure that everything can migrate, and I render everything at least double the resolution of the display that I'm using. So make an archive of files that can recreate the piece pretty as easily as possible.
Hmm. That makes sense. And Well, I mean, because in a way that's also kind of like making films. I mean, and I don't know if that had its, genesis in some way in Hollywood, but Hollywood certainly works that way. And, the crossover to digital has been partly successful because things were shot on film on such high resolution that it can work.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that was part of the thinking, but... It's that kind of paradigm of thinking,
mm-hmm.
perhaps, which works. So then what was the next step? You still have a relationship with a gallery in L.A., I guess, and then how did Lehman Malkin come into the picture?
I had a show in the Istanbul Biennial, I don't remember what year, like 2001 or something?
Mm.
Maybe 2004 or 2003. At any rate... it was the work. It was trees. It was the first trees, and they were projected in a cistern, which was created for a palace, maybe 1,500 years ago, and it was built out of found Greek and Roman like pillars and architectural components. And a couple of these were these Medusa head sculptures that were used as supports. And so I projected these trees where the branches move like the snakes and Medusa's hair, and it just became this really enchanted environment. And next thing I knew, Lehman Maupin was asking me if I wanted to do an exhibition, and they gave me 2 months, and I said yes. And I made my next set of trees, which were trees that were attempting to whirl like dervishes, and it turns out there's a lot of similarities in the sort of looping qualities or the cyclical qualities in a dervish performance as there is in something I do with animation. So at any rate, I showed these trees, and it was January in New York, and it was freezing, and it just seemed like it's created this sort of moment, which was really nice, and maybe like it was a fracture or something, and it became one of the, I think there's two shows in that period that were really great for me. The one was the trees in Istanbul, and then the trees in New York. So, you know, it's, every now and then you get sort of highlights in your career, I guess, and which are so nice. I guess you kind of live for them or something.
Well, that are part, you know, chance and coincidence, it sounds like. In
mm-hmm.
that,
oh, yeah.
I mean, that was around 2000. That was just after 9/11. That was after 9/11, that show in New York?
Yeah, it was after 9/11, yes.
Mm. Yeah, it's you know, I mean, that reminds me of a, I don't know if it was a pivotal show for the artist whose name I can't remember, but there was a show during 9/11 in New York. I lived in Chelsea and still have a place there. But when I was going around, there was one artist who had, you know, kind of simple installation in a way, but it was a time-lapse image of a camera in Brooklyn looking at Lower Manhattan. It was the entire projection of a wall of a gallery, and it
mm-hmm.
simply took an image every 3 seconds. Right, and so you saw boats going by, and you saw the, you know, Manhattan, and that was, it was, the show was actually running during 9/11, so it actually captured all the footage of 9/11, and after the show,
God.
It was still running, so it was like, it was kind of horrendous and horrific, but it was also kind of like hard to believe that was all happening, and it also took up the it's all that was in the gallery. It was all that was in that space. Kind of incredible.
Things like that happen. Yeah, it's crazy.
So the trees in New York, I mean, it's post 9/11. That sounds kind of like, the reason I asked that is because in that context, the winter, everything, it seems like that's exactly what New York needed at that time too.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, it was really cold. Yeah, maybe.
Well,
I don't know. Yeah, I made a piece about nuclear, like, explosions and things, and then Fukushima happened, like, within a month. I mean, horrible, but, you know, just things happen.
Hmm. Yeah, it's kind of interesting and odd how that happened. So then
mm-hmm.
after that, so in New York, in both of those, which sound very successful, that sounds like another big step up in your career. Did you continue teaching or?
Yeah,
that?
I still teach. I teach at UCLA in the Design Media Arts Department.
And was it ever part of your thinking to stop teaching or because your career
oh
is growing?
Well, I've been half-time for quite a long time. So I've cut back because it just takes up a lot of time and energy. But no, I really enjoy teaching, and I get a lot. I figured out that I, for some whatever reason, I like to help people. So I don't understand why exactly, but it seems to be important. And so that it's just part of, you know, it's part of my deal. You also get a lot of inspiration from helping people. And
right.
you know, and just get, you know, other ways of looking at things, and I think I would be too locked into one way of thinking if I didn't teach.
Right. Well, and thank God you're teaching actually with an attitude like that, because everyone needs more teachers, mentors who not only like helping them but are excited about the project and satisfied in their
mm-hmm.
own career.
Yeah.
I mean, you probably heard
yeah.
not most students have that experience with professors in, you know,
well,
in MFA
yeah.
programs, period. So do you see something different happening with students today? Has there been a shift in how students are thinking about art?
Oh, I think it's always shifting. I don't know if I have a generalization. I think women are much more vocal, which is, thank God.
Right.
I mean, compared to when I first started out. And that includes myself, too, for heaven's sake. No, I don't think I have an answer for you off the top of my head.
That's fine. And so,
that I think about it. Mm-hmm.
And so now you're based in You're teaching at UCLA, but you're not based there? You're based in...
No, I'm in L.A.
You're in L.A., so you're based in L.A.
Mm-hmm.
And how do you find the art scene in L.A. as opposed to the East Coast, New York? Is there a discernible difference that you notice or no?
Oh, gosh. There's so many talented artists in either city. It's probably a little bit easier to live here.
Hmm.
And the weather, you know, you don't spend so much time putting on clothes. So,
right.
I don't know. It does seem a little bit easier to get things done. That would
yes.
be, but you know, I think you figure out, you know, just figure out how to deal with things no matter where you live.
Well,
I mean, maybe LA would drive people who live in New York crazy and they'd never be able to make any art if they lived here. That's possibly pretty true.
Right. Well, Jennifer, it's been great talking to you. I really enjoy hearing about, you know, what do seem like a lot of interesting threads between your career and how you began and what you've been working with and how you developed your practice, you know, in many ways at its infancy and, you know, in terms of technology and have evolved so much. This program is reaching a lot of artists, and so perhaps in closing, I'd just like to ask you, is there anything you want to say to the artists that are listening who aren't just young artists, they're artists of all stages of their career,
mm-hmm.
who are not necessarily...
I always tell people to do what they want. I mean, I got to tell myself that, too. You know, you should you have one life and you should do what you want.
And what
so,
do I mean exactly? I mean, everyone's thinking about their art and how they're producing it or whether they're in the marketplace. Or
well,
gallery.
Don't compromise. Don't compromise. You know, don't get yourself messed, you know, into situations where you're going to be so disappointed because you're, you know, setting you know, just agreeing to do something, whatever. No, you got to just do what you want. Oh my goodness,
Jennifer,
I know, really vague, but.
That's okay. I mean, in a way that is true. You know, part of what artists struggle with is, you know, having to make compromises. You know, I mean, getting different jobs is certainly one of them, but it's also, do you have to make art less or not because you're working more? And, you know, you've been in the fortunate position where you can cut back, I guess, somewhat on teaching and make more art and, I imagine that's something you wanted to do earlier, but it wasn't.
Well, it's even in the making of the art, you got to do what you want, too.
Hmm.
You know? So whatever that, you know, it's certainly different for everybody.
Right. But I like that. Do what you want. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Jennifer, for being with us today. I really appreciate talking with you, and I'm grateful for your time.
Well, sure. I guess I must have wanted to do it.
Oh. You're listening to Yale Radio WIBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.